This is the BBC.
Welcome to The Verb, recorded in front of a live audience at the BBC Contain Strong Language Festival in Hull. This week, we're celebrating new poetic talent, the power and the special qualities of poetry by young people. One of the world's best incubators for this talent is the Foyle Young Poets Award, which is run by the Poetry Society, and this year, the competition marks two decades of nurturing the next generation. Joining me in this celebration are the fantastic poets and former winners, Phoebe Stooks, Jay Bernard and Caroline Bird, who's also a judge of this year's competition. And I'm delighted to welcome two of this year's winners, Georgie Woodhead and Maya Damber-Winner. So, Caroline, your first book was published at the amazingly young age of 15, but let's begin with something from your latest collection, which is called In These Days of Prohibition. Let's hear it.
Hello. So I write a lot of poems about shame. I always think that I'm writing about something else, but it circles back that way. So when I came across this news story about an extreme demonstration of self-love, my first reaction was to take the mic, which I have done, don't get me wrong, but I also came across some crumbs of hope along the way. So this is a poem called Megan Married Herself. She arrived at the country mansion in a silver limousine. She'd sent out invitations and everything. Her name written twice with a and in the middle, the calligraphy of coupling. She strode down the aisle to At Last by Etta James, faced the celebrant like a keen soldier reporting for duty, her voice shaky, yet sure, I do. You may now kiss the mirror. Applause, confetti. Every single one of the 140 guests deemed the service unimprovable, especially the vows, so from the heart. Her wedding gown was ivory, pointedly off-white. After all, we have shared a bed for 32 years, she quipped in her first speech. So I'm hardly virginal, if you know what I mean. No one knew exactly what she meant. Not a soul questioned their devotion. You only had to look at them, hand cupped in hand, smiling out of the same eyes. You could sense their secret language, bone deep, blended blood. One guest eyed his wife hovering harmlessly at the bar and imagined what his life might have been if he'd responded years ago to that offer in his head. I am the only one who'll ever truly understand you. Marry me, Derek. I love you. Marry me. At the time, he hadn't taken his proposal seriously. He recharged his champagne flute, watched the newlywed cut her five-tiered cake, both hands on the knife. Is it too late for us to try? Derek whispered to no one as the bride glided herself onto the dance floor, taking turns first to lead, then follow.
That's such a great poem, apart from it explores the comic possibilities of the name Derek, which yes. Is always good. But it's like a parable or a fable, isn't it? But if there's a moral at the end, then it's not an obvious moral. So if there is a moral at the end, what is the moral at the end of that tale, do you think?
I don't know. Writing a poem is always that process of discovery, like this quote by Mary Ruffle, where she says, if you know where the poem's going to go, it's a bit like starting at the top of a cliff that you haven't climbed, yeah. Right? So, and often when I think I'm writing a sarcastic poem, it will ambush me with real feeling along the way. Mm. And I think that's what happened when I was writing this poem. And I think also because, I mean, I definitely couldn't marry myself. We've got a lot in common, but we're not very nice to each other. And so there was something, I developed admiration for the strangeness and the extremity of it, I think, as I went along.
So I suppose the moral is then that seriousness can creep up. Can creep up on us. And we're talking about young poets today, and I wonder what your younger self would make of that poem. Are there any echoes of her in there?
Well, I think she would have thought it was a bit too neat and that the pain in it was a bit too subtle. But I think my younger self was, well, actually exploring quite a lot of the same ideas then as well. I remember writing a poem called The Song You Left Behind, which was about falling in love for the first time and you couldn't meet them or see them, so you like did impressions of them in the mirror and tried to like become them. Or you know, and I was always interested in this idea of how a relationship with another person is also a relationship with yourself.
And would the younger one, the younger Caroline, expect that, I don't know, the younger poet always expects that the older writer is going to somehow be much more serious and have much more gravitas than the younger self? Do you think they would have thought that?
Do you think so?
Yeah.
Maybe. But then I think the younger you are, the more gravitas you have with that kind of, I was so much older then.
Yes.
I'm younger than that now. When I was 15, I was world weary, you know, battle scarred. And everything hurt. I was just I had so much stamina for agony, you know, and now I don't have as much stamina. I mean, then I used to write like my pen was on fire, and now I take breaks. So, you know.
Well, we did mention that your first book, Looking Through Letterboxes, was published by Carcanet when you were 15. And I wondered, what was your experience of having a book out at that age? Because was there a focus when it came out on the novelty of being that young rather than the poems?
Definitely. On one hand, it was incredible like that, to have the editor, Michael Smith, say, what you're doing is good, carry on, and you know, to have that someone believe in you that much. And then, obviously, when the book came out, a lot of people did not like the fact that a book was published by a 15-year-old. And I remember I got this terrible review in The Guardian that my parents had to hide from me because it said it was so bad they thought it was a hoax. It was the worst Sestina that he'd ever read in his life or whatever. And I think I remember I got another review which said that it was infuriatingly juvenile, which is quite funny, seeing I was 15.
Well, let's hear another poem. Can we hear A Toddler Creates Thunder by Dancing on a Manhole? Could you introduce it for us, maybe as if you were at a workshop for young poets and maybe telling them why this poem works?
Okay. Well, this poem, I think, is about one of the best things I've ever seen with my outer eyes. And I remember watching it unfold and taking notes. And then I went back to my room and I wrote and wrote and wrote. I didn't know what it was going to mean. And I decided to get disqualified from my own poem, that I was just going to go past the finish line of where I thought the poem would end, over the motorway, into the forest, and see what happened there. And that's what I did with this. So it's called A Toddler Creates Thunder by Dancing on a Manhole. At first, she cannot account for the noise. With each jerked step, a thunderclap. Her metal dance floor echoes her jive. Her pumps, no bigger than mini croissants, each create a cymbal crash. The earth responds to her slightest step. What dark sorcery is this? What topsy-turvy witchcraft? She pauses to evaluate a scientific test. She retreats to the grass, jumps, no thunder. She jumps back on the manhole, thunder. She sees her powers are site-specific, unique to this one patch. She returns to her sacred sphere, a pint-sized Jedi embracing the Force. I see it happen in her face. From this beer garden bench, book propped, ornamental in my hands, I see her eyes spin like stop signs, red to green. Now she cannot be silenced. Prospero in rainbow leggings. Stormlord. She gambols fitfully on her audible stage. Toddlers always dance like marionettes, their brains still learning the strings. The men behind me are quaffing hipster ales. I just don't want to feel shit in terms of, there's never a good way to end it. Daisy, I mean, she's fine. I turn my phone face down on the table. But what's this? A swerve in the plot. A second child, same face, same rainbow leggings, approaches the rim of the arena. This is mythological. Siblings dueling over the tempest touch, yet within the magic circle there is room for only one. The twin hovers her trainer over the metal. She pauses, draws back. I see her thinking, what if I can't replicate the sound? She doesn't focus on the manhole, its looseness, percussive material, the reasons for the noise, but rather on her sister's ability to conjure it. For the twin, it is not guaranteed just anyone could make this dance floor sing, or that her identical weight must yield identical magic. The conclusion is unknown, therefore a risk. She lifts her foot again. I miss my mouth, pour beer down my shirt. Again, she withdraws. Her brow squeezes. A moral flashes through it. And like that, she folds, cross-legged on the grass. Consents to spectate. She will not trespass on her sister's fairy ring. Steal her thunder. Oh, the humanity! Generosity unsurpassed, but wait, there's more. She begins to applaud that fleshy infant clap, its value enhanced by the coordinative strain. The hipsters are discussing licorice rizzler. It's like flavoured smoking. They chortle like scrambled cassette tapes. But look, now the tiny dancer is a celebrity, applauded by her own mirror image, an audience of herself, like that dream where everyone looks like you. I pick up my phone, type I'm sorry, then delete it. I picture a world of admiring clones, assigned doppelgangers bred solely to approve of unremarkable feats. A second me, sat cross-legged on my shadow, shouting, "Bravo!" and "It's a miracle!" She can summon salty water from her eyes.
Fantastic. We've got three winners, the Foyle Young Poets Award, all at various stages of their careers here today. And I wonder, let's think about what the experience of winning the competition has been and how has it helped you develop as a poet. Jay, what would you think your experience of winning the competition has been, and what did it do for your poetic career, I suppose?
It was a nice affirmation when I was a teenager. I think this is becoming less and less the case, but certainly when I was younger, I was the kind of weird, lonely person, if you know what I mean, like the kind of weirdo in the corner who had read T.S. Eliot and was like, who the hell's that? And then when I won the Foyles, it was like, oh, I can graft, I can put work in, I can fail, because I was commended the first year, and then like come again and be among this quite lovely community of people, kind of like around the world, if you know what I mean. So that's kind of what it did for me, really, and it seems to have kind of haunted me for the rest of my life.
In a good way.
It's like every 5 years or so. It's like, oh, you were a four-year-old poet, and that's quite lovely.
And Phoebe, how about you? How's it developed your work? Or?
I don't think I would be doing any of the things I'm doing now if it wasn't for Foyle Young Poets. It's had a massive, massive influence on what I've done. I wasn't that keen on the idea of even going to university, and now I'm doing a master's in creative writing, like, and that would never have happened if it wasn't for Foyle Young Poets. And also I think there was a sort of unspoken thing with my parents of like, what are we going to do with this child? I didn't really want to do much. And then as soon as I found poetry, I was like, oh, this is what I was supposed to be doing the entire time. This is what I'm supposed to do. And Foyles really encourages you, and they treat you like a professional. They immediately, you know, treat you like you're a writer who's been doing it for a while. And I think having someone have that level of confidence in you when you're that young is so important, yeah.
I'm thinking about people's early poems. I think about my early poems that I wrote when I was just before I was a teenager. They were very pretentious. And it's easy to knock pretension, but I always think pretension can have great value, because I think pretension is a way into learning. I always thought when I was younger, you had to have a word in the title that nobody else would understand. So one of my first works was called Zoismic Poem. I didn't understand the word myself, but I thought it had a certain je ne sais quoi. So what youthful mistakes did we make? Caroline, what youthful mistakes did you make, do you think, on the way?
I liked saying things three times when I could say them once.
Yes.
You know, I enjoyed the momentum of words. It was much harder to edit. I remember going on that first Arvin course for the Foyle Young Poets and having this tutorial and them striking through a line that I'd written, and it really, like, hurting, like it scored into my heart. But then only, you know, 6 months later going, OK, all right, I concede that line could go, you know. Whereas now I really enjoy slicing them up.
And what about you, Jay? What was your... the idea of pretension?
Yeah.
I like the way... I don't mind people being pretentious, but did you feel that, looking back, that your early writing was aiming towards pretension?
I don't think it was aiming towards pretension. It was just pretentious. I think I tried to be sort of nice to my sort of younger self, because it's really hard, I think, to, A, pluck up the courage to do this stuff in the first place. Mm. And then sometimes I'm actually quite impressed that as a 15-year-old with some of the things I was reading. Things like, for example, I would show up at an event and still writing the poems, you know what I mean? Like still trying to get the gravitas, and would go up with these dog-eared bits of paper and trying to read and trying to be this person. I think there's a lot of bravery and courage in that, as well as I can laugh at some of my really early poems that literally were along the lines of, hey, hey, my name is Jay, hey, hey, I'm gay, like that kind of... That kind of like brash, really cringy, in your face kind of stuff, which was really a way of kind of like working things out.
Have you brought a poem with you that we could hear?
Yeah, this is a poem that I don't think it's that cringe, super cringe. Right. It's just sort of kind of cringe, if you know what I mean. And like obviously looking back at it now, I can pick apart this poem and see why it doesn't work. But at the time, I think I was trying to say something. You know, I'm black, I'm queer, I've lived in Croydon, I sort of grew up not really among literary people, but I had this sense of being alienated in all the various cultures I was in. So I wrote this poem called Cadence. Mm. And now I can look at this poem and basically be like, oh, this theme of alienation, cultural alienation, and yet sort of being quintessentially sort of like something and trying to get at that is still a theme that I'm kind of returning to. But this poem is called Cadence, and it was in my very first pamphlet. It came out when I was 19 or so, I wrote when I was 17. So Cadence. I should consider this cold British soil and island for a funeral like you do. But in the cusp between the Middle Passage and the Windrush, something changed in the chronology of things. I should imagine someone on a yellow hill feeling the same inward discomfort as me, stumbling star-crossed along the planet like me. But centuries like haunted masts curve between us. We could trace ourselves to a time when there were no nations to think of, when people saw what made them different and fell in love with it. Being young is an oxymoron. Our genes are as old and gnarled as the moon. They are genes only. We're columns of blood biding time, caught between the delicate cadence that binds us. Yes, but that doesn't mean I owe a thing to you.
Within that younger Jay, there is the older Jay, isn't there? It is like a Russian doll or something, do you think? You can see yourself in there. You can see that the poet you're becoming is in there somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can also see that I've read, you know, Romeo and Juliet and... sort of stolen a few bits in there, you know. But it's almost the way it ends without... It's quite pat, do you know what I mean? Mm. And it doesn't develop, really. Like you were saying about climbing the rock face, I kind of already knew what I wanted to say and didn't dig very deeply, because I think there's a kind of fear in that, if you know what I mean. I think a lot of the things I'm kind of trying to do today are, yeah, based on this idea, being young is an oxymoron, we're columns of blood biding time. Actually, I think those are quite... They're not bad, actually, if I may say so myself. And I think it's just the whole thing.
And entering any competition, especially at a young age, is a leap into the unknown. So, Phoebe, how did you know your poems were good enough to enter? Did you enter them yourself? Did you have a supportive teacher or a mentor who said, let's enter these?
Well, my mum was my English teacher during middle school, and she does foil hers every year with her students, and she did it with us, and she was like, but no, we never hear anything. She was like, no one ever wins this, so we're doing it, but you know, nothing ever happens. So it's set up a disappointment already. But I don't think that is the good thing, is that I never thought about whether or not they were good enough as a result of that, because I was like, oh, this is just something I'm doing now. The first time I entered, I never thought I'd hear anything about it. So I didn't have that thing of like, oh, are these good enough? I also hadn't read enough poetry to know whether it was good. It wasn't until, like, I think the first album course I went on that I knew that you could sort of put things in form. Like, they were all in block paragraphs.
That's the thing. That it always is a continuous and continual learning process, isn't it? Now, Caroline, you've brought along a poem from that first collection.
I have, yes.
Can we hear that, please?
So I wrote the poem when I was 14, because I think round about that time I realised that my parents were people, and I wanted to find a way to express that realisation. I have to apologise for the fact that this, it says light as a feather in it, but I think in my defence I thought I'd made it up. So it's called Playing at Families. When you can pick up your mother in thick-set hands, roll her over and tenderly remove her wings. When you can rip off your father's moustache with a twitch of finger and thumb, telling him, it'll never do good with the ladies, not anymore. When you can place them on your shelf like miniature models, knowing that every night they search the bedroom, looking for lovers and empty wine bottles, but melt into the carpet when you open your eyes. When you can arrange your grandparents in tiny velvet chairs and gently put them in the embers of the fire, soothing them through cooing lips that you're well-fed and educated, so there's no need to worry. When you can put your relatives in separate boxes to make sure they don't breed or cut each other's hair while you're out of the house. When you can lift them, light as a feather, kiss them and tuck them in matchbox beds, making sure your family are locked in innocent slumber before leaving to go clubbing every night. When you can do all this, then you have to face the guilt when finally, after too many years, you creep back in to find each wide awake and crying that they hadn't known where you were.
Thank you very much, Caroline Bird. Now it's my great pleasure to introduce two of the winners of the Foyle Young Poets Award 2018, who are going to read their winning poems. First up, Georgie Woodhead, who's 15 and from Sheffield. So, Georgie, could you read your poem, "When My Uncle Stood at the Top of the Office Block Roof," please?
When my uncle stood at the top of the office block roof, he swayed from side to side, half-glug bottle locked in his burning fingers, his silhouette framed by the black hole of night. Flecks of scornful planets blinked behind his back. The whole world stretched out in front of him like the sides of a fallen down box, and his eyes had been opened and stared open as his shoulders shook. His feet stumbled back and forth towards the edge, the leather of his shoes creaking in protest against the gutter. When the bar had closed and we were tossed out, left to stroll with our hands shoved in our pockets like tree stumps rooted in earth, we heard his bottle, a free-fall smash into green teeth on paving slabs. He leaned over his small carnage in the same silence as we did, our mouths open, eyelids pinned apart, necks turned like twisted cloth. And him, with his frown slashed thin, disappointed, eyebrows folded as if he had honestly expected anything different.
So, Caroline, as a judge, what stood out for you for this poem? Because I know I've been a judge. You have to read a lot of poems, don't you? Thousands of poems. So what stood out about Georgie's?
So, I mean, you've got this uncle at the top of an office block roof, for one thing. And you have so many emotions communicated in 14 lines. I mean, in great poems, emotion doesn't feel like a noun. It feels like a verb. It's going through it, you know? And it starts off really dangerous, right? But then it also goes through affection, humour, sadness, in so few words. And also, it's just such an interesting idea, this someone wanting to make a big statement, but they don't want to jump. It's that call of the void, you know? If it was a less good poem, you'd have them jumping, right? But actually, the fact that just the bottle falls and then there's that disappointment at the end, it's just brilliant. I don't think I'd ever read a poem about that need to do something dramatic that then sadly becomes pathetic, you know? It's just brilliant.
So, Georgie, you're part of the Hive Young Writers in Sheffield. How's being part of that group helped you develop?
Well, I first came to the Hive Young Writers when I was 13 years old, which was a year before I was supposed to. So I sort of, you know, I lied about my age and kind of like gatecrashed it. But it turned out that no one really seemed to care about that. And the whole group is incredibly supportive, and it's run by Nick Perring and Vicky Morris, who have helped me tons, you know, giving advice about editing, and I always found editing a really difficult thing because, you know, I didn't really like going back and looking back at stuff because I felt like its time had passed. But I feel like now I kind of see the importance of improving things and looking back on things.
All right, well, thank you very much and congratulations, Georgie Woodhead. Next up, Maya Damber-Winner, who's 17 and from Leeds. Maya's winning poem is called "Mr. Sigiriya's Weird and Wonderful Talents." So, Maya, could you read it for us?
My dad always told me never to speak to strangers, so I always ended up just speaking to my friends. I heard about him first from Tommy. We were walking home from school, our backpacks heavy, sweat dripping from our spring brows. "Mr. Sigiriya can tie himself in knots, you know." I didn't believe him. We watched some talent show on TV and contortion suddenly made a lot more sense. Next, it was Emily, I think. "Mr. Sigiriya cries leaves, only little ones though. Imagine crying leaves from your tear ducts." I didn't know an awful lot about ducts or biology. My dad told me the old man must have green fingers. I wish I had green fingers, maybe even purple ones. Adam received a birthday invite from Mr. Seagiria, apparently. Adam said he had almost perfect calligraphy, other than a mistake on the K of his last name. Stephen said that Mr. Seagiria once walked into his garden, rolled up his shadow and put it in his pocket. He started to roll up his foot too, but stopped when he saw Stephen watching. There was that one time Lily went to water his plants. He told her he could levitate 4 inches off the ground, but only for time periods in multiples of three. I was 12 before I heard about Mr. Seagiria again. I remembered his green fingers, only this time I knew what it actually meant. Victoria told me his house was full of olive trees. They just grew and grew, and no matter what he did, he just couldn't ever stop them. I liked olives. I wanted to meet this Mr. Seagiria and ask about his trees. I asked my dad if I could visit. He said no. I know someone once told me he could catch a butterfly without breaking its wings. I thought that was easy, and then I broke a butterfly's wings. When I was 14, I met Mr. Seagiria. He told me he was a photographer. He could take perfect Polaroid photos with his eyes and print them out of his mouth. I asked if he was ill. He said that he was fine. I walked home. My dad woke me up the next morning with the news Mr. Seagiria had passed away. Clearly he'd been lying. It's funny because I always thought he'd float up to heaven or morph into an olive tree or something. He had a bunch of weird talents like that. I guess the only one he was good at was dying.
Again, a fantastic poem. Caroline, can I ask the same question again? What stood out about Maya's poem?
I mean, first of all, you have so many brilliant images and ideas crammed into one poem, rolling up a shadow, printing Polaroids out of his mouth, crying leaves. But also, Maya's poem, similar to Georgie's poem, made me learn something and think about something I'd not thought about before, about how part of growing up is realising that even the magic people are mortal, you know? And so much time passes in the poem as well, and there's so many characters, and yet it also completely knows itself.
Maya, I'm intrigued by the use of names in the poem, the names of the friends, but particularly Mr. Seagiria. So where did that name come from?
So I'm half Sri Lankan, and for a lot of my work, if I'm doing something, you know, unusual or weird, I'll reach for, like, unusual names. So a lot of people don't know a lot about Sri Lanka. Mm. So when I was writing this poem, I wanted to reflect that kind of, I mean, distance for me. I'm being, like, having lived in England my entire life. There is kind of a disconnect for me to Sri Lanka. I don't really know the culture very well. Mr. Seagiria is this unknown character. It's the childhood Chinese whispers phenomenon. Everyone knows something about him, but they don't know anything true. Seagiria is a rock fortress in Sri Lanka. It's that kind of symbolism, I guess.
And I want to know about the earlier drafts of this poem, because it is very conversational. Mm-hmm. And was it like that from the start?
No, it wasn't. I must admit, a lot of the time when I write, it's literally me, notebook, pen, and I'll just write what I'm thinking. So this poem started off as a double-page spread in my notebook. It had no punctuation. It was just one continuous line. So then when it came back to editing it, I noticed that I'd kind of broken it into sections with the different people. Mm. And it actually worked in terms of splitting it into, you know, four lines. And it went through continuously.
Well, thank you very much, and congratulations to Maya Damber, winner. You're listening to The Verb with me, Ian McMillan. And if we've whetted your appetite for writing poems, visit the Poetry Society website at poetrysociety.org.uk for details of the Foyles Young Poet Award and all the winners and much more. And if we've whetted your appetite for listening to The Verb, head over to our podcast feed where you can feast on us until your ears are full. Now, Phoebe Stooks is an exciting new voice. Her debut pamphlet, Gin and Tonic, was published last year. She's a Barbican young poet and has been a winner of the Foyle Young Poets Award not once, not twice, not three times, but four times. So, Phoebe, can we have a poem? Can we hear Three Spells, please?
Three Spells. Lost boys, go home. I like my boring life. I'm hard as silver and you are a fleshy blood thing. Get out of my hands and my inbox. Mother, deliver me from gin headaches. I've lost enough Sunday mornings as it is. I've written enough thank you notes and apology letters. Now is the time for manifestos and songs. Girl, have a peppermint tea and sleep on it. Keep hold of your story like a dog on a lead. Trust me, you'll burn through these months like sage.
In that poem, it seems to me that you're writing to yourself, but also to your generation. And I think there is a golden generation of poets in the 20s and early 30s at the moment. And do you feel part of that? And who are your contemporaries that you look to?
I'm really lucky to be surrounded by amazing poets because I've done things like Foyle Young Poets and Barbican Young Poets. I'm not sure if I feel like I can sort of align myself with some of these people because they're too good. That's it. But if I'm just going to list people quickly. Imogen Castles, Dom Hale, Sarah Fletcher, from Barbican Poets, people like Victoria Bully, people like Amal Said, who's an amazing poet and photographer. I'm really excited about a lot of the poetry that's being made at the moment, definitely.
Yeah. It does feel like we're in a fantastic time for poetry, it does. And your style is very direct. I love the directness of it. Has it always been this way? I think about, 10 years ago, did you have a style when you started writing? And did it take you to develop the style we've got now?
I think when I started, I was very, overly sincere about everything, and now everything's got, a slight sort of twist of irony on it, hopefully. But the directness, I think, has come relatively recently. When I started writing stuff for the pamphlet, I think I was feeling frustrated about what sort of poetry I was supposed to be doing. And then I was like, no, this is what I actually want to do.
Well, let's hear a very direct poem. Could you read Experience for us?
Yeah, sure. Experience. How could you really know yourself if you'd never had that fake hair extension ripped from the back of your head in the car park of the big Tesco? Sometime in the spring of 2010, the scrap of synthetic lace in your thighs, already stained with blood, already too fat for your cutoffs, and a girl called Jessie, the most frightening and gorgeous being you had ever seen.
That kind of teenage experience doesn't often make its way into poetry, I don't think, in a great way like that did. And it's great to see the supermarket car park being seen as a place of myth and poetry, I think. That's the kind of place you write about, and you give it majesty, I reckon.
I grew up in a very boring town, so things like the Morrisons or the Tesco car park is a big deal. That's where the sort of great events of your life are played out when you're like 16 and you live in Minehead. I wanted to sort of write about this sort of like high camp femininity, which I think is coming back into fashion now. It's having a moment, this sort of very early 2000s style is coming back. And that is so strange for me because it's how we all used to dress when we were 12. Yeah.
And your poems are often short, and people that say that short poems are easy to write, but is that your experience? And then do you need confidence to know when a short poem is enough or when a poem is short enough, I guess?
I think I have a problem of not being able to write long poems. I've got one long poem and I was knackered afterwards. There's a musician I really like called Mitski, and she's a sort of indie rock punk musician. She says no one's going to listen to her noodle for 20 minutes. She said no one will give me that. And I think that's how I feel about poems, is I sort of get it done and then get off, you know, finish talking and just go and sit down, yeah.
You're going to read a poem, True Crime, which elevates something else not often seen as fit for poetry, reality TV. Could you introduce it for us and then we'll hear it?
Yeah, I love reality TV. I also love any sort of true crime thing, particularly the stuff that's really poorly made. My favourite thing is a series called Deadly Women, which is terrible and I'm obsessed with it. I don't know, I think I believe in like a sort of wide range of influence because I like read a lot of poetry, but then I also love TV and I love music and everything like that. So my mission at the moment is to kind of bring the reality and poetry together and to make the kind of poetry that exists in the real world, definitely. Yeah.
All right, let's hear it. True crime.
True crime. I want to know why she does this, I guess. The killer and her inability to problem solve. Like, how else can she pay off her credit card debt? What else can she do when he leaves her? Kill them, of course, kill him. Most women go for the gun because you can keep your victim at arm's length. But some just want them gone. I can recall one woman who did the deed with the brutal spike of her blue suede stiletto. Her name was Anna Trujillo, and I had to Google woman kills man with shoe in order to tell you all this.
Thank you. That blue suede stiletto is almost too perfect, and it kind of wouldn't work if it was fiction. But it works there. Were you ever tempted to change it, to make it something more mundane?
No, because that's the truth. That's what did happen within that case. That's why I think a lot of... That's something I discovered when I got really into watching these sort of like murder documentaries, is that life is sometimes weirder than the stuff that's written down. A lot of detective series are in some ways like more tame than these cases because it seems unbelievable. Mm. And that I just heard that it was a high-heeled shoe that she used in this murder, and then I Googled it and I found out it was a blue suede stiletto. And I was like, that's just sort of too perfect, you know.
All right, and what about that last line, or the penultimate line, woman kills man with shoe, that's the thing you typed into the search engine. That in itself is it's a kind of new language that we're using, isn't it, when we type in a few keywords into the internet. And that almost becomes a poem in itself, woman kills man with shoe.
Oh, totally. I'm very into the idea of the sort of poetry of the internet. But it's because I couldn't remember her name. I knew that this had happened and that somebody had killed somebody with a stiletto. I just couldn't remember what she was called. And, you know, having that information at your fingertips is inherently weird anyway. Yeah.
Certainly is. Well, thank you very much to Phoebe Stooks. And Gin and Tonic is out now from Smith Doorstop. Phoebe Stooks. Now, we heard earlier from Jay Bernard. Now, Jay Bernard's a poet, performer, winner of this year's Ted Hughes Award for their performance piece, Surge, Side A. So let's begin with a poem, Jay, if we could.
My voice, it was so weak, so sick and so grieved. My voice, it was so weak and it broke in the heat. So sick and so sad, my voice, it was broke. So low was the hope that it sickened, I choked. It closed in my throat. My voice, it was weak, so sick and so grieved. My voice became glass breaking in heat. I called and no one seemed to call with me, and no one seemed to know or see what I had seen. I was so sickened and so grieved. And I said to the child I knew harbored in the fire, jump, Yvonne, jump, Paul, jump. And I said to my God I knew harbored in the fire, jump, Yvonne, jump, Paul, jump. I said, I called, jump, Yvonne, jump, Paul, jump. My voice, it was so weak, Paul, jump, so sickened and so grieved.
They do talk a lot, don't they, about young poets finding their voice, but it seems to me that what you're doing is finding multiple voices in your writing. Is that right? Do you feel that there are multiple voices coming out in the work that you're creating?
Absolutely. This comes from a piece I've been working on for some time now called Surge, and it's based on the New Cross fire that happened in 1981. It took place in sort of Deptford, New Cross, and it's unsolved. Basically, 13 kids died, West Indian kids, and the fire really resembled the sort of racist, fascist attacks that were happening at the time. So there was a lot of speculation, a lot of questions about what had happened. Mm. Total mystery, nobody really knows. And so the obvious sort of way to go about that and to kind of investigate that and to see how it's kind of come down to us over time was to use multiple voices. Mm. This particular poem actually comes from sort of working in the archives of the George Padmore Institute, where I was watching a film that had been made at the time, or just a year later even. One of the parents said this. She said, she didn't say my voice, but she said I was so weak, I was so sickened. Mm. And she said, and I knew that the children were harbored in the fire. And I thought that was just such an intense line. I just had to repeat that. And that became the poem. And that's kind of how the whole collection kind of transpired.
Because you described Surge in an interview as a text in flux. And I think that's how it feels. And so I'm working with this multiplicity of voices allows, doesn't it, for a kind of shifting and morphing within the work as it develops.
Absolutely, and as I've been working on it since last year, when it started to kind of crystallise a bit, changes every time. Like, every time I read it, it's different. Every time I perform it, it's different. I think that's kind of important. I think there's something interesting about writing a collection that still knows itself as a spoken, performed thing.
Because it can always change. That's the exciting thing about it. And taking you back to when you first started writing poetry, what were your early influences? Was it other poets?
Yeah, absolutely. Like Phoebe, I was quite lucky in that I was part of many groups, or a few groups. I started out at the Battersea Arts Centre, like way back, and the poets who were sort of teaching me then are the poets I'm literally working with now. So Malaika Booker, for example, was someone who ran workshops with us. Roger Robinson, Nick McCullough, all of these. Ethan Mannix was a huge... I loved Ethan Mannix so much. Like, all of these sort of people who... orality was part of it, but also this kind of there was a culture, if you know what I mean. And you talk about like gate crashing, Georgie. You talk about gate crashing. I kind of gate crashed as well. And you kind of like you're hanging on the tailcoats, coattails even of these sort of much older people who were in pubs and talking and just kind of enjoying literature. It wasn't something in school that you were studying. It was something that you talked about, you know.
And we're recording this programme in autumn, and the seasons have been written about a lot, but that doesn't mean that you can't look at them in a fresh way. It's good to hear your poem that's about autumn.
Yeah, this is a continuation of the theme around the New Crossfire. Autumn, in all its orange dresses, sipping rain in Fordham Park, a tire swing eclipses the world within its hoop. I have found the stone with the names of all the dead. I sit and meet the stone's cold pink mirror. Garbled sun, 13 names. Every year, I hear summer ask how autumn can endure winter's undoing.
So I guess because autumn has been written about a lot before, one way to approach it is to make it as part of a bigger project, which is how that fits in, doesn't it? So it's not as though you're writing a poem about autumn. Autumn simply happens to be the setting for the continuing evolution of the piece that you're writing.
Absolutely. That's a kind of real thing, in inverted commas, that happened. I was sitting in Fordham Park, where there is a memorial. What crossed my mind was this kind of the way that memorials work, if you know what I mean. Now, if you think about seasons and the cycles, I feel like memorials are like that. You know, you have these anniversaries, you have these like big years. But the memory actually, I think, particularly something like the New Crossfire, actually fades over time. Do you know what I mean? So you have this like stone and this rock which seems permanent, and the intention was to kind of like, you know, to recognise, and but actually it's sort of faded, and I don't think anyone really knows why it's there anymore.
Now, can we finish with one final poem? Could you introduce it for us and then we'll hear it?
Sure. This last poem I wrote in memory of Thomas Crosby, who was a young poet that I worked with, Eastside Arts, and he passed away about 2 years ago now, in sort of quite tragic circumstances, really. But he's remained with me because he was part of this kind of group of young people, if you know what I mean. And we used to meet every week and like do all these workshops together. And he was always just a real delight and a really lovely guy to kind of be around. He was a rapper and he had that kind of like cheekiness and spark. And meditating on his passing has actually really informed, I think, the way I've thought about the young people who were involved in that fire as well. It's become part of my own act of memory and way of memorialising these people. So, I have seen the light you've seen, and my body has been where yours has been. Some part of me resides where you reside. We've swapped presences and parting. I have seen what you have seen become the part of you I stood beside. Passing friend with green eyes, I now reside where you reside. Hello, you standing to the left of me, you in the heart of those hearing me read. Further ahead on the road we are walking, there in the shadow performing in front of me. You in the rhythm that's always unfolding, you are a question that's always been asked. Who are we now and what are we wanting? How do we ask the quiet you felt, what voice you recalled, whose hand you were holding?
Thank you very much, Jane. That line, who are we now and what are we wanting, feels to me that it's at the heart of everything we've been talking about today. That's what all poets, young and old, are asking. Who are we now and what are we wanting? Thank you very much to Jane Bernard and to my other guests, Caroline Bird, Phoebe Stooks, Georgie Woodhead and Maya Dambe-Winner. The Verb was produced by Jessica Treen and presented by me, Ian McMillan, at the BBC Contain Strong Language Festival. And do listen out for more from Contain Strong Language. Our unwritten special will be on later in the year. Goodbye. Thanks for listening to the Verb podcast. If, like me, you're always hungry for more poems, you're in luck. We're not going yet. So, Caroline, could you do us a poem?
So, this is about something that happened to me nearly 10 years ago when my life was quite different. It's called Stephanie. She was 18, used party as a verb, lashes like the whiskers of an oil-soaked seal, devoured books with names like Steamy LA Nights Under the Duvet by Flashlight. I was 23,
brooding over John Ashbery between therapy sessions, hunched at the smoker's table like a misunderstood genius. I was recovering from a bout of goodbye world. We were both diligent pleasers. I fell in love with the reflection of someone charming in her sunglasses. I always wanted to be charming. I forgot we were ill. When I finally touched her, her skin dilated. She shuddered, licked her teeth, and crawled towards me across the bed. It was like watching a child possessed by the vengeful spirit of a murdered porn star. I locked myself in the bathroom and then strode to the nurse's station to confess. Afterwards, my counsellor said, "We really dropped the ball on this one, placing a sex addict in a room with a lesbian." She wrote me a 10-page love letter in red ink. The nurses tried to lull my guilt. If an alcoholic screams for a whiskey, it's not the bartender's fault if he pours. I didn't like being compared to booze, like I could have been anyone. The acne-scarred chef who grinned at her once, the pin-eyed new boy, the mouthy car washer at the NA meeting, like it was just because I was her roomie and she was a nympho and nothing to do with real electricity. Or Stephanie somehow spying the part worth saving in me.
Thank you very much, Caroline Bird. Phoebe Stooks, have you got a poem for us?
Carrie, 1976. Have you ever seen a woman in a plastic tiara throw up? I have been her. Dressed up as Carrie, straight men and dogs were licking the fake blood from my arms. I think it was the man with his face painted up as a skeleton who spiked my gin and tonic. He could have wrapped his hand around my upper arm as I unlocked my door. I try not to imagine anything. I go where I please, but I'm being hunted. I'm holding this year down and waiting for it to die. The new one trawls in like a married man, and his shadow eats mine on the pavement.
Thank you very much, Phoebe. And Jay Bernard, do you have a poem for us?
I wanted to read something light and funny. Oh, not funny, just light. This comes from a commission that's part of this festival, actually, called Unwritten. And I started writing about World War One. And I sort of created this kind of fantastical thing, actually, where a young sort of black girl living through that time dresses up as Sarah Forbes Bonetta, the cenotaph. Speaking so wistfully of other springs, from the little gardens of little places where son or sweetheart was born and bred. A quarter of the sundials whiter than the rest, like the lighter square behind an absent frame. Here the shadow fell for years, the unknown dead their final hours known by the unbleached stone. The doctor's daughter stands behind the house, fixed in that brown and fading light, a photo in her hand of Sarah Forbes Bonetta, that straight-backed portrait with the book and chair. She calls, "Look," and out they come. She's dressed with finest leaves along her skirt, white flowers on her sleeves, black lace pinning up her hair, daisy bangles looped around both wrists. She's tacked a Doric column to the wall, burned its edges brown as antique light. And isn't this her captain? She takes the boy's arm, puts petals in her father's hand. Now throw. There's a photographer close by who never sleeps and walks around the studio barefoot. They'll spend the evening there and decorate the room with shady trees and leaves across the floor, pearls at her throat. Laughter in that little room. The like you might imagine in the photo's painted groves. A stolen night in Peckham. Quiet rye. A tilted tray. And in the albumen, aristocrat / ex-slave. The wartime kid who finds her beautiful and brave.
Thank you very much, Jane. Thanks to all my guests. And see you next week for more Verby Delights. Thanks very much for listening. And if you liked us, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, because it really helps language lovers to discover the Verb podcast, and what a discovery that can be, as you know.